1 Samuel chapter 28. Seems like Sunday nights are about the strangest time I have with my computer. I give up.
Did you put it back on the airplane? Take it off the Wi-Fi?
Yes, I did. I have some very nice slides here. You'll just have to take my word for it. 1 Samuel chapter 28. This is a very unique story. In fact, I would tell you there's no story in the Old or New Testament that's similar to what you see in 1 Samuel chapter 28. It is wholly consistent with everything the Bible teaches us about what happens when a person departs from this life. Where does their body go? Where does their spirit go? I think I mentioned last... What did I just do? I'm going to have a little bench put right up here. this is kind of like I was talking about Andy Alexander years ago, how he was a longtime friend of mine. Some of you know him. He didn't talk until he was about 4 years old. And when he was asked as an adult, I was in a group of people, he said, "Why did you wait so long?" He said, "Well, everything was going okay till about that time." So he never had anything he wanted to say. Well, that happens to me, except when my computer messes up. 1 Samuel chapter 28. I want to go back to chapter 13 just for a moment. We're talking about the life of King Saul and the death of King Saul. And this evening we're going to be talking about the death of a great prophet by the name of Samuel, as well as the death of the first king, King Saul. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, Saul made several blunders. But I want to back up a little bit and say he was what the people were looking for. When they said in 1 Samuel chapter 8, "Give us a king like all the nations round about us," they had a specific idea in mind, and God knew exactly what they wanted. They wanted a big, strong warrior. They wanted somebody where they didn't have to wait for God to come rescue them with a judge or bring somebody else up, that they had a warrior to fight for them. So God's plan was, "I'm going to have Samuel tell you exactly what it's going to cost you to have a king. He's going to enslave your young men and they're going to fight for him. He's going to enslave your women. He's going to take money from you. But as long as you want it, then you can have it." And so he gave them exactly what they wanted. Not long into that, 1 Samuel chapter 13 and verse 8, he was about to fight the nation of the Philistines. This was one of the nations that in the time of Joshua were not driven out from the land of the people of God, and so they were a constant threat to them. In verse 8, he waited 7 days according to the appointed time. This is chapter 13 and verse 8. "Set by Samuel, and Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. And Saul said, 'Bring me the burnt offering and peace offerings,' and he offered the burnt offering. And it came about as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering that, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and greet him." He was so happy to see him. And the first thing that happened, Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Because I saw the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Mishmash, therefore I said, 'Now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked for the favor of the Lord.'" Verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, "You have acted foolishly." God told you very clearly what he wanted you to do. He wasn't ambiguous. He made it very clear. And he says, "You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord will have established your kingdom over you forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure." The first mistake that Saul makes, God said, I was perfectly happy to have your son Jonathan be the next king and his son be the next king, and I would have established you from the beginning of time. But he said, because of the attitude that you had. I list this as Saul's sins, because in every single case, he directly violated what God told him to do, and that was a sin. So in verse 14, your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord had commanded you. Look in chapter 15 now. So in the three strikes in your out world, this was the first strike that Samuel said that against Saul. In chapter 15, you remember the story of the nation of Amalek. But this is the second time God makes it even more clear. Your kingdom is not going to endure. Your son will not be the next king. When you take a look at chapter 15 and verse 24, Saul said to Samuel, I've sinned. And he said, yes, you have. And he says, I have indeed transgressed the commands of the Lord and the words, because I feared the people and listened to their voice. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. And Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. This is the second time he made it abundantly clear. Your kingdom will end with your death. Now, I will tell you, after Samuel comes back from the grave in chapter 28, he's going to tell him who the next king is. There's no indication that he knew that David had already been anointed by Saul. So in verse 28, in verse 27, Samuel turned to go, and Saul seized the edge of his robe and tore it. Samuel says, I'm not going back with you. I'm not offering a sacrifice. I'm not praying for you. God's told me he's done with you. So as Samuel takes off to turn, Saul grabs him and rips his garment. In verse 28, Samuel says to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom from you, from Israel today, and have given it to your neighbor who is better than you are. And the glory of Israel will not lie nor change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. So he's made it very clear, this is the end for you. In 1 Samuel now, chapter 28. In 1 Samuel chapter 28. So Samuel by this time has told Saul twice, your kingdom is not going to last and you can't change it. All the glory that you could manifest in the entire nation of Israel is not going to cause God to change his mind. He's decided that he's going a different direction with this nation and you're not going to have any input whatsoever. In chapter 25 verse 1, this great man, Samuel, dies. Now, he will be in the life of King David. I will just tell you, there are three prophets, in the time of David. The first one is Samuel. Samuel's the one that anointed him. He went to Jesse's house. The next king would be, would be Nathan. Nathan was the prophet in the time of Bathsheba and afterward. And the third prophet that would prophesy during the time of David was Gad. And that was when David numbered the troops at the end of 2 Samuel. So David became king slightly after the death of Samuel. So Nathan and Gad would be the two primary prophets that he would deal with. In 1 Samuel chapter 28, I want you to read this with me. It is a unique passage in every way that you can imagine. It says in verse 1, it came about in those days that the Philistines gathered their armed camps for war to fight against Israel. And Achish was a neighboring king. You can see that in the chapter before, from the nation of Gath. That was one of the Egyptian nations. So this is another king that was friendly with David. Know assuredly, he says, that you will go out and with me in the camp, you and your men. And David said to Achish, very well, you shall know what the servant can do. And Achish said to David, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life. Verse 3, Samuel was dead. And all Israel had lamented and buried him in Ramah in his own city. And Saul had removed from the land those who were mediums and spiritists. Now I want to have you look just for a moment. You take a look up here Actually, it'll come up in just a moment. In the book of Exodus and the book of Deuteronomy, God had demanded that no spiritist, no witchcraft, no anything was removed from the land, but it would creep back in. Do you know that we're talking right now at a time that is around 1050 BC? Let's go forward to about 740 to 720 BC in the time of Isaiah. And what you see there is, we're reading this in our class this morning. You want to consult with your spiritist. You want to consult with your mediums. And Isaiah says, why would you consult the dead about the living? Now, the point I'm making here is this was something that was very common in the east of them for a long, long period of time, hundreds of years. And that is fortune tellers and witchcraft and all type of spiritist type activity. What you're going to see in this text is this witch of Endor that he snuck over and had a conversation with, when she conjured up Samuel, she saw a whole lot more than what she thought she was going to see. All of this was sleight of hand. All of it was trickery. All of it was games, just like Simon the sorcerer in Acts chapter 8. So when you see this come up, the reason why she was scared to death and yelled because she had no clue what she was looking at. Now look a little bit further. In verse 5, Saul saw the camp of the Philistines and he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. The Urim, you can take a look, I've given you an example in Exodus chapter 20. There were two little figurines that were kept close to the heart of the high priest, the Urim and the Thummim. And they were right in front of the heart, and they were to help the high priest understand what God wanted him to do. And so it was very clear to Saul that the Spirit of the Lord had left him. God wasn't sending prophets to him. He wasn't giving him visions. There was no contest or no communication. In verse 8, Saul disguised himself by putting on other clothes and went, and he and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night, and he said, conjure up for me, please, and bring up for me whom I shall name to you. Now, right above, you can see this woman was called the medium or the witch of Endor, E-N-D-O-R. I've looked several times and tried to do a little research on this. There is nowhere else in the entire Bible that you hear this phrase, conjure up for me, or bring up for me. This is the only time this occurs in Scripture, because this kind of stuff was just completely foreign to the people of God, except for the ones that went completely off the deep end. So he has disguised himself because it's against the law, and this woman doesn't want to lose her life. And so he sneaks over to a foreign country where it is legal, and he comes in and says, I want you to bring up for me or conjure up for me a particular person. And the woman said to him in verse 9, behold, you know what Saul has done. At that time, she didn't recognize him, obviously. How he has cut off those who are mediums and spiritists from the land. Why are you then laying a snare for me, for my life, to bring about my death? And Saul vowed to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord lives, there shall be no punishment come upon you for this thing. Now this is something interesting that I want you to think about. Saul broke God's law with some regularity and with impunity, thinking that I can break your law. I can offer sacrifices. I don't have to wait for Samuel. I can decide that I'm going to make the people happy, and I'm going to change a little bit what you want to do. But now he's telling a woman, I can even speak for God. I'll make sure that nothing happens to you, even though you're breaking God's law. And so it's okay for me to do it, and it's okay for you to do it, because I've made it okay. In verse 10, Saul vowed to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord lives, there shall be no punishment come upon you for this thing. And the woman said, whom shall I bring up for you? And he said, bring up Samuel for me. I have no doubt that she knew who Samuel was. Samuel was an icon in his day. He was a godly man that had done much for the nation of Israel and nations round about. Verse 12, when the woman saw Samuel, I want you to think about the phrase conjure up, and you think about probably like I do, here's a witch putting all kind of things in a potion and stirring it, and there's smoke and all kinds of things. But he says, he uses the language, bring this person up for me. Keep that in your mind. In verse 12, when the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice, and the woman spoke to Saul, saying, why have you deceived me? For you are Saul. Now, I don't know what she saw, but it was a whole lot more than what she thought she was going to see, and a whole lot more than what she expected. She had no doubt been making money from this, tricking people for some period of time. When this actually happened, I think probably much like Simon the sorcerer, you remember in Acts chapter 8, when he actually saw the power of the Holy Spirit, he couldn't believe it. He'd never seen anything like this. This woman didn't know what she was seeing, but she saw a person coming from the dead. And in verse 13, the king said to her, "Do not be afraid, for what do you see?" And the woman said to Saul, "I see a godlike being or a divine being coming up out of the earth." And he said to her, "What is his form?" And she said, "An old man coming up, and he is wrapped with a robe." And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed his face to the ground and did homage. So when she actually was able to bring up Samuel, she didn't know what she had done. Saul didn't know what she had done. He's asking, "What are you seeing? What are you seeing? Tell me what you're seeing." "I'm seeing an old man, and he's in a robe, probably like a burial robe or something of that sort." And she asked, "What is his form?" "Well, he looks like a divine being that's coming up out of the earth or from the earth." In verse 15, Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Now, this is New American Standard. I was going to look at King James. What does King James say on that? Any of you that read King James? Disquieted. That's right. That's right. "Why have you disturbed or disquieted me by bringing me up?" And Saul said, "I'm in great distress, for the Philistines are waging war against me, and God has departed from me and answers me no more through prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I called you, that you may make known to me what I should do." He had been his assistant from the time Saul was a young man. Samuel was very close to him, and so he didn't know what else to do. God had already frozen him out. In verse 26, Samuel said, "Why then do you ask me? If God has already shut you out, I've already told you twice that your kingdom was going to end with your death. Why are you conjuring me up? Why do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary?" And he said, "And the Lord has done accordingly as he said through me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and giving it to your neighbor, to David." I've gone back and looked at the Chronicles. I've taken a look through the wisdom literature. There is no indication that I've seen that Saul knew who the next king was going to be until this time. When did Samuel tell it to him? After he was dead. And Saul is going to die the next day. So he tells him here for the first time, "David is your neighbor that will be the next king." Moreover, in verse 18, "As you did not obey the Lord and did not execute fierce wrath on Amalek, so the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also give over Israel with all of you and your hands along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me." I want to come back to that phrase. We're going to talk about that in chapter 31 in just a moment. "Indeed, the Lord will give the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines." I want to talk for just a moment about, when I talk about this story being wholly consistent with everything else the Bible, Old and New Testament, says about death, we can see a few things. Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 7, is the best definition of death that I think the Bible gives us. The body goes back to the ground where it came from, and the spirit goes where? Back to God who gave it. When you can see people giving up the ghost, I will tell you throughout scriptures, a number of times when people are in the process of dying, the text will say that they could feel their spirit departing from them. There's an interesting phrase. I'm not going to look at this, but if you want to study, I think it's Genesis 37. When Rachel died, you remember Rachel was the mother of Joseph and Bathsheba, Benjamin. It says that she knew that her spirit was departing from her. This is what happens in death. And what you see is the body, over the course of time, just becomes dust, which is, that's where it came from, and God said that's where it's going back. The reason God sees death so different than we do is because we see a body. You have a body, and I have a body. And when I don't see your body anymore, then I don't see you. From God's perspective, the part of you that is really you, that He knows, is going to be here eternally. Whether it's in a body or whether it's not in a body. That's why you see so many passages. Matthew 22 is an example that says, "Have you not read that I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob?" In Luke chapter 13, there's a song that we're learning called "Standing Outside." But it talks about when you see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, and you yourselves are being left out. So what you see in this text is, to God, a human being is a human being, whether they're in bodily form or not. So here Samuel says, you don't need to worry about the war. I'm going to tell you this battle, the Philistines are going to wipe out everybody. And oh, by the way, you and all and your three sons are going to be with me tomorrow. Think about for just a moment Luke chapter 16. In Luke chapter 16... you have a place that is known as Hades. Hades is where spirits go when they leave the body. When you see the story of the rich man and Lazarus, there's a great gulf. And over here we have the rich man. And over here we have Lazarus. Abraham makes it very clear. The rich man can see Lazarus. He can remember Lazarus. He can remember his life. But Abraham says, you can't come over here. And oh, by the way, you're asking for Lazarus to put water on his finger and touch your tongue? Can't happen. He can't go over here. The gulf is fixed. When you think about 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 10, we must all give account for the deeds done in the flesh, whether good or evil. Now you can look at many times where when people die, they can see one another, but they are in different places. I have no idea where Saul was compared to Samuel. Do you remember when Jesus said to one of the thieves, the one that actually defended him, he said, "Today you will be with me in paradise." You remember that? So here Samuel is saying, you don't really need to worry about the war. You don't need to worry about what's taking place because you and your whole family, your three boys, are going to be the same place I am tomorrow. In verse 19, moreover, the Lord will give also in the hands give also Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, for tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me. Indeed, the Lord has given the armies of Israel into the hands of the Philistines. Saul immediately fell full length upon the ground and was very afraid because of the words of Samuel, and therefore there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all that night. It's interesting that in verses 24 and 25, he's laying there like a dead man, and this witch of Endor is concerned. And so she cooks him a meal and makes sure that he eats, forces him to eat. Now turn with me to chapter 31. And I want to talk about the rest of the story. In this situation, the battle actually takes place. If you followed chapters 29 and 30, there were several battles, but this is the final one, at least as far as Saul and his sons were concerned. You remember Samuel just said, "You and your sons are going to be with me tomorrow." Well, this is tomorrow, the 31st chapter. Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons. And the Philistines killed Jonathan, who was very close to David. They were best friends. Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle went heavily against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. And so his three sons now have already been killed in the battle. So you can imagine, here's an archer that sees someone and he shoots, not really knowing who it is until the next day when they're cleaning up the corpses. So in verse 3, he was badly wounded by the archers. In verse 4, Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and pierce me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and pierce me through and make sport of me." But the armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. I would imagine he was greatly afraid because Saul was a man with a violent temper. If we were to study all of the times, how many times he would have this evil spirit come upon him and he would grab a spear and throw it at David or throw it at Jonathan or throw it at his daughter Michal, who would be the first wife of King David. And so he had this vicious temper. And so this armor bearer is not going to do that. What if the battle actually turns different and you live? And then you string me up. So in verse 5, the latter part of verse 4, "So Saul took his sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him." So this is the fulfillment of what Samuel told him. Tomorrow, you and all three of your sons, there was not going to be a son left to try to fight to be the next king. It was done. God cleaned his house out in one time. Now there's something interesting, because one of the great fears that Saul had was, "Kill me," he says to my armor bearer, "because I don't want these people to make sport of me." Well, after his soul departed from him, he didn't really have a whole lot of say, and there was a fair amount of sport made of him. In verse 6, Saul died with his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men on that day together. It literally, God closed the book on this story. It was Saul and his entire family and his army. When the men, verse 7, the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley with whom were beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in them. And it came about on the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons. Now you think about it, you've no doubt seen Civil War, you've seen Revolutionary War movies and documentaries where they're coming in picking up swords and picking up whatever they can pick up that might be a benefit, and they come across somebody and they say, "This is the king. This is the king, and these are his sons." And they're laying out here in the middle of this battle dead. So look at what happens next. In verse 9, they cut off his head, that's Saul's head, and stripped off his weapons, and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. And they put his weapon in the temple of the Ashtaroth. Now you want to talk about, his biggest fear was that these uncircumcised, ungodly people were going to make sport of me. The first thing that happens, they cut his head off. And they send his head around to all of the places, all of the people that would be their future enemies, to say, this is what's going to happen to you if you don't straighten up and do what we tell you to do. And then they put his weapon in the temple of one of the gods that he would have hated, most disgusting gods, and that is the temple of the Ashtaroth in verse 10. And they fastened his body to the wall at Bethshan. Now here was a very prominent, large city that they wanted to attack next. And what they do is they hang the headless body of Saul on the fence. What do you think the purpose was? When I was young, I don't know that I still see this anymore, but it was pretty common when my dad preached in Damon and Rosenberg. A lot of the people that were members of those congregations were farmers. And on a pretty regular basis, they would catch and kill a coyote or a wolf or a number of other animals like that. Anybody know what they did with the hides of those animals when they killed them? They hung them over the fence. And the feeling was, whether that was true or not, the feeling was that all other wolves and coyotes and foxes would see that and say, we're not welcome here. Now, I don't know if that actually worked or not, but certainly the old-time farmers did. So this was a case of humiliation. It was a case of saying, we're shipping the head, and we're carrying the head of Saul all over the nations for you to see how powerful we are. And they hang his body, his headless body, on the outside wall of a city. In verse 11, when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men rose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his son from the wall of Bethshan, and they came to Jabesh and burned them there. So Jabesh-Gilead was where he fought his first battle. It was where the majority of his warriors had come from. You can see that in 1 Samuel chapter 11. And so this was a place that was very near and dear to Saul, and they were very near to him. And so they were not going to let that stand. So they walk all night long, and not putting in some type of cart, but they take the body off of the wall, and they carry it. And they carry it back, and they burn it. This is not uncommon for this time, but commentators would say they did not want more foul play. The reason why they burned his body was they didn't want somebody digging it up and doing the same thing. And so they burned his body. And then in verse 13, they took the bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted for 7 days. So let's close up just a minute talking about what happened here. Go back to chapter 28. Saul was a man that was what the people wanted. Give us what we want. I think about this oftentimes when I think about our politics today, and we decide what we want. This is what we want. We don't care what you do as long as you don't mess with our Social Security. As long as you give us this and give us this and give us this. And if you ever give us anything, you can never take it back. And we're willing to accept whatever you throw at us, Mr. and Miss Government, as long as you give us the stuff that we want. And what happens is so many times we don't have the ability to see the long-term implications of what we have agreed to. And that's exactly what happened here. God says, I can tell you what it's going to be like if I give you a king, but instead of telling you, I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you for 32 years. That's how long Saul was the king, for 32 years. I'm going to show you what it looks like, and I'm going to give you exactly what you wanted. Saul was a warrior. His father was named Kish, and Kish was a great warrior, but he was a nothing on the inside. He was a person that had no inside. He had no moral compass. He had no fear of God in his heart. He was more afraid of the people. And you can see that multiple times. You remember not too many months ago, I did a lesson about Eli. And Eli was a high priest that God had frozen out. That's why when little Samuel heard these voices and he went into Eli, Eli didn't know what it was because he hadn't heard the voice of God in many years either. But he said, God said to him through this same little boy when he was young, you were more afraid of your children than you were of me. Now That's the statement that the little boy Samuel, God gave him a message and he delivered the message. In this case, he wanted to be loved by the people. He wanted to be respected and revered. And so instead of being a leader, he was more afraid of the people. And that really was his downfall. So what happens is God allows him to exist for the majority of the time. Both David and Solomon reigned 40 years. He only made it 32 before his death. But God allowed him to be completely humiliated in his death. Now, isn't that an amazing thing? The story that is contained in chapter 28 is a one-of-a-kind story, and that is, these spiritists, these mediums, had no ability to conjure up anybody. This was also the plan of God. That's why, when you go back to chapter 28, look in verse 12. So this woman is going through her spiel, and basically, all of a sudden, she sees something, and look in verse 12 at what happens. The woman said to Samuel, and when she saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice. And the woman spoke to Saul and said, "Why have you deceived me for your Saul?" I don't know what she saw, but she saw way, way more than what she had ever seen before. But it was part of God's plan. And God used this plan to close the book once and for all. Saul, I'm not helping you. I'm not going to pray to God for you. I'm not going back with you. And above and beyond that, you don't need to worry about how the battle's going to turn out, because you and your boys are going to be with me tomorrow. So when you see in 1 Samuel chapter 31, as we go through, and we're going to be studying the books of Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah, you're going to see that the kings of the northern kingdom were vicious, ungodly men. And for them stabbing and killing each other in the middle of the night in their bed, or killing their daddy while he was taking a shower, you're going to see all of those. Those were very common things. But this was not common in this day and time. But I would say God made it very clear that I am closing the book on the house of Saul. Already told him he wasn't going to be king, that his kingdom was not going to endure, and I'm going to make sure I'm wiping out his boys, I'm wiping him out, and I'm taking all of his army, and they're all going to be killed on the same battlefield at the same day. When you begin 2 Samuel, you can see, it says in verse 1, "It came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, David remained," and so it basically picks up the story in 2 Samuel of King David. The book has been closed on Saul. And it was a pretty amazing way that he did this, through the story of bringing Samuel up from the dead. Our time is up. So we have a song that we're going to be led in. Brother Charles will lead us in our song of encouragement for the evening. What number are we looking at? Number 301. So we'll offer the invitation at this time to anyone who might have interest. If you need to make acknowledgement, let it be known as we stand together and sing.